Well, thank you very much. Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me here. And, well, secondly, I want to apologize for not being able to write this nice chain of formula on the blackboard. My handwriting is very bad, so I will be showing transparencies. And, well, there will be not very many of them. And this is the first one. This is the title, and the word Neumann is not there. It was just a mistake. I'm going to talk about Neumann in Dirichlet-Laplacian. It doesn't really matter. And this is the first thing which I want to discuss. Well, names are all right. Everything is fine with names. The paper will appear in Communications Mathematical Physics shortly, I hope. And the only thing which I want to comment on is the word rough in the title. Actually, the results which I'm going to present holds for any boundary, and for smooth boundaries as well. And it will not be asymptotic results, but precise, explicit estimates with constants which don't depend on anything but the dimension. So I hope that the results are new even for smooth boundaries. But on the other hand, if you want to prove a result in, well, Y-like result for a smooth boundary, you must understand that there is Ivry's book, which contains basically everything, well, anyone knows about asymptotic behavior of eigenvalues or whatever. So this word rough is a sort of self-defense.
It also contains things which nobody knows.
True. So what this word means? Well, everybody knows as well that Professor Ivry likes the Kohn condition. So good domain is the domain which satisfies the Kohn condition. So our domain is the domain
for Neumann only.
For Neumann only, but still. But our domains don't have to satisfy the Kohn condition. So this gives some hope that our results are new and cannot be obtained, are not simple consequence of Ivry theorems. So the word rough means exactly that, nothing else. You can forget about it if you don't know. So this is the first transparency, and the second one, well, I shouldn't be really showing the second transparency because everyone knows these things. Well, I call it notation. Well, why formula I will cover for a second. I call it notation. It just, well, we are going to consider the Euclidean space. It's a very simple problem. I hope that the talk is going to be very simple. Of course, not as simple as Nazarov's talk, which was even simpler. But basically about all the same level of complexity. So we are going to consider the Euclidean space. These are coordinates, and this is the usual agreement that x prime is the first coordinate, and, well, x is this thing. Q will denote, well, the usual cube. And C is the size of the cube. If you don't have any C, the C is just any cube. Mu is a dimensional measure. I don't really know whether I have to say anything about it. Well, lambda squared, of course, is important. It's a, well, convenient agreement. It's more convenient to define the counting function of lambda squared. Well, this is a convenient agreement. I will write N without any index if it's, well, it refers both to Dirichlet and Neumann boundary value problem. If it's Neumann boundary value problem, there will be M capital. If it's Dirichlet boundary Neumann problem, Dirichlet boundary value problem, it will be D capital. And well, this function, the Neumann Dirichlet, sorry, counting function is locally bounded. Everybody knows that, I hope. But the Neumann counting function isn't necessarily bounded. The Neumann Laplacian may have continuous spectrum. Essential continuous spectrum, so it may be plus infinity in this case. And next, as I said, the talk is going to be very simple. So the next thing which I am going to discuss is the Weyl formula, which of course everybody knows, and I've showed that physicists know the complete asymptotic expansion for the counting function, but I am going to stick to the first term of the asymptotic expansion, well, the classical Weyl formula. And the classical Weyl formula is here, well, two of them. The first is, well, just says that the main term, asymptotic term for the counting function is this. This is the Weyl constant, doesn't matter what this constant is. Well, it depends only on the dimension, and this is the volume of the domain, and this is lambda, the power of d, d is the dimension, and this law of the term. This formula holds true, all this holds true for the Dirichlet-Laplacian. As far as I know, this result was proved by Berman and Somiak in the 60s. I think it's theirs. Dirichlet. For the Dirichlet boundary value problem, this is always true, and this is due to Berman and Solomyak. And then this is an improved version of the value formula which contains precise remainder, and this D1 is the upper Minkowski dimension of the boundary. If you don't know what it is, just don't bother. It's not important. Under certain conditions, we can obtain this estimate, and here I don't know what the proper reference is. I give two references to Vandenberg and myself, simply because in these papers we obtain precise estimates. Well, explicit estimates in the, for the remainder term. But obviously it was known long before. Kuhlberg. I don't know who was first. It's a sort of folklore now. Everybody knows it. It's common knowledge.
Simply.
What year was that? What year?
Early 70s.
With the exception of Hausdorff dimension. Berry conjectured this formula with the Hausdorff dimension. He thought that D1 must be, well, the Hausdorff dimension of the boundary, which was a mistake, it's Minkowski dimension of the boundary. But you don't have much, you don't have to know much to prove this formula. It's really very elementary, can be proved in many different ways. And so it's really not important who proved it first. But this.
Because that idea of
the
second term of Berry never
holds. Oh, yeah, this Hausdorff dimension is, there's little doubt about it. Hausdorff dimension is totally inappropriate. Right, so this is the valve formula. I just wanted to show the valve formula to let you know what I'm going to talk about. Well, this are two formulae. And, well, what I'm going to discuss today, well, the second formula. Really, I'm going to discuss the following thing. What we can say about the difference between the real counting function in the first term here. What, how we can estimate the difference. And I'm not going, I don't want to impose too many conditions on the boundary. So domain is going to be more or less arbitrary. There will be some conditions which I will introduce later, or maybe even now. So the domain is going to be whatever you like. So what are precise conditions? For the Dirichlet Laplacian. For the Dirichlet Laplacian, well, the results will, the results are true for any bounded domain. Doesn't really matter. And of course those results are known. Well, I'm sure that Professor Ivry will remark on this, and of course they are known, but we have a nice formula, an explicit estimate, not an asymptotic formula, but a simple and explicit estimate which may be of some interest. For the Neumann Laplacian, so just any domain, bounded. But by the way, when I say domain, I mean connected open subset of the Euclidean space. Connected is important. The word is connected. Connected is important. And then for Neumann Laplacian. Well, I like to formulate it in the following way. For the Neumann Laplacian, our results hold true for any domain with a continuous boundary. But of course, then the question is, what is continuous boundary? Well, what is the continuous boundary? In our definition, the boundary is continuous if it's locally the subgraph of a continuous function. Sounds very innocent, well, very general domain. But actually it's not. For example, Koch-Snowflex is not a subgraph, of course. Sounds like a very innocent condition, but unfortunately it's not true, and not every domain is locally subgraph, and the reason why we have this condition is actually ridiculous. First, when we were proving all these results, we thought it was almost nothing. Why don't we assume this? So we did. So, well, we didn't want to have the con condition, so we dropped the con condition, and we introduced this condition as local subgraph, that our domain is local subgraph. Bounded and connected. Domain is a bounded, connected. Boundary doesn't have to be connected. The domain is connected. So first we thought it was an innocent condition, and well, we understood that we had to pay a price for dropping this con condition. And as usual, when you pay the price, first you think that you have a good deal, and it's just that, and then you understand that you overpaid. So in this condition, I think we overpaid, and I'm going to explain a little bit later where this condition can be relaxed. So I don't know how to relax it. And again, it's a very typical situation. I know exactly what we need to prove our results, but I don't know how to put in words. I don't know how to explain in a nice way what conditions we need. Subgraph is fine. It's a nice way. It's a sufficient condition. This condition can be generalized. And it's perfectly clear what we want. But it's very difficult to say in words. But I will come back to this a little bit later. So let's assume that for n, for the denominal Laplacian, we have a continuous boundary in the sense that it's a local subgraph. And for these domains, well, I will show our results. But of course, this condition doesn't exclude fractal boundaries. I know that many people like the word fractal, because many fractal boundaries are there. No, not necessarily. Continuous simply means that our domain is locally the subgraph of a continuous function. Continuous function may be as bad as you want, nothing else. But it's locally a subgraph. Well, you can have angles, you can have spikes, you can have cohorns, whatever you want. But it can't be a snail-like domain, for example. Snail-like domain. The projection, there is a hyperplane such that the projection. But as I said, I think we have overpaid here that this condition isn't really necessary. It's convenient, but not really necessary. So this is what I'm going to discuss today. And the next thing, for really bad domains, all this advanced technique, which was discussed in many talks in this conference, doesn't work because we don't have reflected ray, billiards, we don't have anything. The domain is far too bad. So the only thing which we can do is to apply the good old variational technique. And here is the definition, here's some results about variational technique. Actually, this result, it's not even a result, it's definition. The first thing is, just definition. Well, the last time I don't want to show right now, I will discuss it a little bit later. It's just a definition. Well, this is a Sobolev space, I don't think I have to explain. This is the usual norm of the Sobolev space. This is a subset of the boundary, and this is how we introduce this function. And this function, in usual words, is a counting function of the Laplacian subject, and so on, and so on, and so on. Actually, this is a definition. There is nothing to prove. Yes. Okay. No, strong sense. C infinity, yes, C infinity. It's not written there, sorry. C infinity. Strong. This was the first question, and I hope I managed to answer it. So actually, this is the definition of the counting function. It's a result that this counting function, if our domain is sufficiently nice, if our boundary is sufficiently nice, and so on and so on, then this function is a counting function of Laplacian, and so on and so on. You don't have to prove it. Basically, this is the definition of this counting function. Now, what can we say about this counting function? Now I'm going to introduce this variational formula, which I'm going to use later. The first observation is very simple, but it's going to be very important in the future. First of all, if we take a big domain, omega tilde, which can, smaller domain, sorry, which is a subset of omega, then the counting function of the Dirichlet Laplacian is smaller on this smaller domain. For the simple reason, the space E lambda over which we take supremum is smaller. The domain is smaller, subspace is smaller. It's obvious. And it's not necessarily true for the Neumann Laplacian, because for the Neumann Laplacian, in order to be able to say that this space on omega on a smaller domain is smaller, we must be able to extend functions from omega tilde to a bigger domain. But it's not always possible, unfortunately. If our function satisfies the Dirichlet boundary condition, if it vanishes at the boundary, we can extend it by zero. But for the Neumann Laplacian, it's going to be a problem. Even with a constant, it's going to be a problem. We are not able to. So, if we take a smaller domain, the Dirichlet counting function becomes smaller. But this is not necessarily true for the Neumann counting function. Very often it's simply not true. And then this lemma here, which I don't really want to discuss, if you like, you can rewrite it for yourself. But basically, this means the following. If we take our domain and introduce an additional boundary with Dirichlet boundary condition, then the counting function becomes smaller. If we introduce an additional boundary with the Neumann boundary condition, then the counting function becomes bigger. If we change on a part of the boundary, Dirichlet boundary condition to Neumann boundary condition, the counting function becomes bigger, and the other way around. This all follows from this definition, because every time when we do one of those things, the space becomes smaller and bigger, lambda. So it's all elementary, and there is nothing else. Well, basically, this lemma is exactly what I said. So if we split our domain into the union of other domains, or smaller domains, and put Dirichlet boundary condition on new boundaries, then the sum of counting function becomes smaller. If you put Neumann boundary conditions, then the sum of counting functions will be bigger.
I like this idea. You keep the domain, you change part of the Dirichlet condition.
Yes. Yeah, that's bigger. It will be bigger.
But that can be
quantified. It can be?
Quantified.
Yes.
Suppose your domain has a measure of the boundary, area of the boundary 1, and you take epsilon out.
Yes.
You know how much things move with epsilon.
Yes. But I don't really need it, but you're right. But I'm just saying very, very general things, very general, simple things, that this is a very basic things about the variational technique. And I ask you to look at the following lemma. It's much more interesting. At least for me. Look at this lemma. Now, what happens if we cover our domain by a family of sets which have non-empty intersections? What can we say about the eigenfunction? And we put new boundary conditions, Neumann boundary conditions everywhere. Well, the natural conjecture, well, it's even better than before, then the counting function must be even bigger because domain overlaps, or the volume is bigger than for non-overlapping domain. But strangely enough, we couldn't prove it. So all we can prove is this estimate. If kappa was not zero, it was just the estimate which would say that the sum of counting function is bigger than it was. Overlaps are good. Overlaps mean that the total volume is bigger. It's general observation. Kappa is a multiplicity, a definition is here, a multiplicity of the covering. But strangely enough, this kappa appears here in the wrong way. Nevertheless, it's sufficient for our purposes. This is what we want to prove our results, but I just don't understand it. So if domains overlap, then, it must be better than they don't overlap. But it's not. For some reason, it's not. Or maybe it is, but we can't prove it. So, basically, the main result here is that we don't have to assume that the domains by which we cover our domain omega are disjoint. They may overlap, but if the multiplicity of this covering is finite, still we have quite a nice estimate for the counting function. I don't dare to say that this result is new. Obviously, if you want to prove it, you will do it very, very, very easier. But I have not seen it in books and papers for the simple reason probably nobody needs it. But we do. Any questions about this variation?
You cannot draw kappa, but see, let's consider two Dirichlet problems. It's very large lambda, then the right side will be just zero, but when you join them, you remove Dirichlet condition.
All right. I don't really want to discuss this because Romania still eight transparencies to show. But this was strange. What is variational technique? How to prove results for the counting function by means of variational technique? This is a basic theorem which everybody knows, I hope, and everybody uses in this variational technique. This is Whitney theorem, which says that every domain is the union of disjoint cubes. Here is a precise statement. And the cubes become smaller and smaller as well if they are close to the boundary. The size of the cube is proportional to the distance of the boundary. This is just a very useful technical result which shows that every domain can be represented as a union of cubes. And so, well, now we are ready to apply variational techniques. We can represent domain as a union of cubes. And here is the classical proof of Weil formula, which I think goes back to Weil himself, or maybe even to Lord Rayleigh. Lord Rayleigh probably didn't prove anything, but Weil, current Weil. Well, all people, before introducing this advanced technique which we are discussing on this conference, all people do this way. So how can we prove a variational, well, the Weil formula for the general domain? What is written here? Let's read it. So we must cover our domain by a finite collection of cubes, and then use the Dirichlet-Neumann bracketing. Namely, on these new boundaries, we put the Dirichlet boundary condition, and then the sum of counting functions becomes smaller than the counting function, or if we put Neumann boundary condition on new boundaries, the sum of counting functions becomes bigger. Then we estimate the counting function of every cube, add them up, and we hope to obtain the estimate for our counting function of, on our domain. Unfortunately, it's not convenient to use the Whitney covering, which comes from here, because the number of cubes is infinite. So when we have an infinite number of cubes, we have infinitely many errors, which come from these boundaries, new boundaries. So if we add them up, we obtain an infinity. So the number of cubes must be finite. But there is very easy trick which allows us to do it. We use the Whitney covering for a little bit bigger domain, for the union of the domain omega itself and exterior of delta neighborhood of the omega. So then the intersection of omega, omega will intersect only with finitely many cubes, then we can do what I said before. And here is how it works for the Dirichlet-Laplacian. For the Dirichlet-Laplacian, it goes like this. Again, I don't want really to discuss it because it's something that everybody knows. But if you don't, well, here is how it can prove. Unfortunately, if we do it in such a primitive way, we have to introduce this condition because, well, the boundary is between, well, our covering of a bigger domain and covering of a smaller domain. So if this condition is fulfilled, then everything is simple. If the measure of the boundary is positive, of course, it's a very exotic case, well, we need some extra tricks. So for the Dirichlet boundary condition, it works exactly as I said. We cover our domain by cubes. We take a family of cubes which covers our domain with some overlap, which is a bit bigger than our domain. Take union of cubes which is a bit smaller than our domain. Then we are trying to make the difference between them very small. Well, just take fine and finer partition of our domain by cubes. And when we pass to the limit, we obtain the Neumann formula, nothing else. So it's all elementary. Right, so this is for Dirichlet. Laplacian. And how it works for the Neumann Laplacian, let's see, this is the next transparency. Still have some time. Here it is. This is how it works for the Neumann Laplacian. What is the problem with the Neumann Laplacian? It's very easy to estimate the counting function from below. Again, just by putting cubes inside the domain. So we take the union of cubes which is smaller than the domain itself, take cubes which lie inside of our domain, put the Dirichlet boundary condition on new boundaries, then the counting function on this union of cubes is smaller than our counting function. Then the sum of counting functions on these cubes is smaller than our counting function, original counting function. So probably it's a bit of a sketch diagram. So this is our domain, and we take union of cubes which are inside of our domain, and bigger cubes which cover our domain, so counting function here, the sum of counting function over the cubes lying inside of our domain is always smaller than the counting function of our domain. And we hope that if we take the counting function on the sum of counting functions, all cubes covering our domain, we obtain something bigger than our counting function. For the Dirichlet boundary value problem, it's true. For the Neumann Laplacian, it's not true for the reason which I mentioned before. So the fact that the domain is bigger, the union of all these cubes is bigger, doesn't necessarily imply that the counting function is bigger, because the boundary may be very nasty. The union of cubes is a sufficiently nice domain, which is sufficiently nice boundary. But the original boundary may be much nastier, much more irregular than the boundary of this union of cubes. So if we take a bigger domain, well, if we take a family of cubes which cover our domain, we still are not able to say, it's generally it's not true, that the sum of counting functions over all these cubes, so, which cover our domain, is bigger than the original counting function. So for the Neumann boundary value problem, this is not so easier. And well, actually, I looked at textbooks, and most of authors prefer just don't discuss it, the Neumann boundary value problem. They discuss the variational techniques, they do all these nice things for the Dirichlet-Laplacian, they say it's very classic, what was done by Weyl, somebody else, but they don't say a word about the Neumann boundary value problem, simply because it doesn't work. They understand it doesn't work, so they prefer not to discuss it. Right. And now, before I proceed further, I want to make one remark. Well, say, for the Dirichlet boundary value problem, everything is fine, everything works. But this technique, this approach is wrong. It's not what we really want. Why? Well, for the following reason. Just take this domain, which we have, and consider a new domain, exactly the same domain, with infinitely many spikes going outside of this domain. Obviously, adding the spikes doesn't change our problem, because they go outside. The problem inside is just the same. But if we apply this technique, we have to take into account the spikes. So if we go outside the boundary, we must take into account exterior properties of the boundary. And this must not be so. This is not the right way of doing things. Well, just cut, straight away, whatever you want. Just spoil your boundary outside of the domain as you want. It doesn't change your boundary value problem. If you want, make a small interior point. But in this example, I don't want interior points. If I put this spike, you can say that this spike can be removed, because it's not a real part of the boundary. This is true. But how do you know can it be removed or not? If it's very narrow, almost nothing, well, you have to prove it. Can be removed or can't be removed. I took this example deliberately. In this case, it's perfectly clear that these spikes don't have anything to do with this interior problem. But why not? You can say that these spikes form part of the boundary. How do we know what we are going to remove outside? How do we know what's happening outside? So the basic idea is that we must not go outside at all. We must not be interested in exterior properties of our domain. So the classical variational technique, which I just described, it's fine, it works, it gives results, but it has this disadvantage. In order to apply this technique, we must go outside, must know something about outside properties of the boundary. If, for example, if you want to prove this Weyl formula, improved Weyl formula W2, which I showed in the first transparency, then we obtain exterior and interior Minkowski dimension. Yes? Yes. Yes.
Demanding the uniform.
Yes.
So it has to be a uniform demand which is able to cut that ball off.
Yes.
So what's the question? The question is, whatever you demand, if you're demanding such a universal
confidence, yes,
it has to be sensitive to, it can't be universal under a Mechanism number where you take a deeper angle.
Well, it will be universal because the technique which I'm going to introduce will deal only with the interior part of the domain. So there will be estimates which will take into account the effect which you mentioned. So I'm going to present the estimates which will take this into account. So, well, at the moment what I want to say is the following. We mustn't cover our domain by model domains, cubes, whatever you want, which go outside of our domain. Because then we are going to obtain unnecessary error, which comes from the outside, from the exterior of the domain, which mustn't be there. So our idea is very simple. We don't want to cover our domain by cubes. No. We are going to cover our domain by some nice model sets, which are subsets of our domain. We don't go outside. And then we are going to do just exactly the same as, before. The Dirichlet-Neumann bracketing and estimates and everything works all right. But of course, well, if we are not using cubes, we are going to use more sophisticated domains, they may overlap. there is little chance to cover a domain by non-overlapping model sets. They're going to be to overlap, but the multiplicity is going to be finite, so we can apply the variational lemma, which I stated before. So the idea is that now, well, our approach, well, here we are going to cover the domain not by cubes, but by some nice sets for which we can obtain effective estimates, more or less explicit estimates for the counting function, well, on those model sets. And we are not going to go outside. And here we don't need the con condition, because the con condition implies, well, the extension property, that we can extend functions outside, so we can use this idea. Since we are not going to go outside, we don't need, well, this con condition. Don't need the extension theorem, don't need the con condition. So what are the model sets? And here is a list of model sets, which rather simple. So the first class of model sets are just rectangles. Well, they're simple, everybody agrees that we can obtain explicit formula for the counting function in rectangle. These sets are open subsets which are sufficiently small. They're subsets of rectangles. And these sets will be needed to prove the formula for Dirichlet-Laplacian. And this is the most complicated the class of most complicated sets. I will probably sketch a diagram here. So what are these sets? These sets are constructed like this. We have a cube of small size, well, diameter, so the size is delta. And then on this cube, we have a function, continuous function defined in this cube, whose oscillation is not greater than delta. So this continuous function, this solves the size of size delta. This size delta and this size delta. And on this size, we have a continuous function which goes, well, as you want. It doesn't go, well, above this line, doesn't go inside this cube, nothing else. So it's a cube with attached subgraph. And the cube is small, the subgraph is small, nothing else. Right, and here's the lemma. Here's what we can say about this set. Well, I think that the first statement is obvious. It's just an explicit calculation. The second statement is not obvious. I'm going to discuss it. The third statement is more or less obvious because the third statement refers to the following case. We have this small set, and this is M. M is here. And we put the Dirichlet boundary condition on this part of the boundary. And then, well, I don't know. It's very easy to see that this estimate holds true simply because the function vanishes on this part of the boundary. So the first eigenvalue can't be very large. It's almost Dirichlet boundary value problem. Well, essentially Dirichlet boundary value problem here. So this I also don't want to discuss. And if Mazia was in this room, he would say that it immediately follows from his theorem number 36 about capacities or something like that. So this is something very well known. So the only real result here, which has to be discussed, is the second estimate. Why this is true? Why it's true that on such a domain, on the domain of this type, the first eigenvalue is not very large. The second eigenvalue of the nominal Laplacian, because the first eigenvalue is zero. Why it's not very large? How to prove it? I'm not going to give a complete proof, I just explain why this is true. In order to obtain an estimate for any eigenvalue, we have to estimate the function by its gradient. L2 norm of the function by the L2 norm of the gradient. So how can we estimate L2 norm of our function in this domain? Take this point. Let's estimate the value of our function in this particular point. We just draw this line segment, which goes from here to there. Then the value of our function at this point is estimated by the value of our function at this point plus the integral of the gradient of this line. Integrate this estimate, and you obtain L2 estimate over this domain you will see that L2 norm of any function over this domain is estimated by L2 norm of your function over this domain plus L2 norm of the gradient. And L2 norm of the function over this domain is estimated by L2 norm of the gradient because it's a cube. And that's it. And this is where we overpaid. It's far too simple domain. It's nice domain. This is what we needed for this domain. But it's just far too simple. If you thought a little bit more about this, it's quite possible that we would be able to construct more sophisticated domain for which we had this estimate. It's just far too simple. this estimate is far too simple. Of course, one can find better model domains for which similar estimates hold. Star-like condition will be fine, but it's not star-like. Yeah, well, yes. But you have to have a cube. You see, the problem here. Oh, by the way, I have still 15 minutes. How many? For transparency, so I can make a remark. Well, the important thing here is that we have this quite fat domain here, this rectangle. So we want to put all the boundary to transfer all problems from here to this rectangle. But we must have some really big, well, nice, solid domain. If you want to consider star-shaped domains, there must be, well, something inside. There must be some sort of circle inside. And this shows, by the way, why, well, everybody knows, everybody who works with Neumann Laplace knows that, well, cusps, inward cusps are not dangerous. So if we have a very narrow strip going inside, well, you can forget about it. It's not going to bring the troubles. But outgoing cusps, very narrow strips which go outside, are dangerous. And here it's clear why, because here we can put this cube here, and, well, everything is fine. The cube and local subgraph, there's no problem. But with the outgoing cusp, we do have problems. We can't put cube here. It's far too narrow. So we must have, our domain must be covered by a nice set of cubes. Well, cubes, balls, whatever. It doesn't change the result. And in such a way that we can project the boundary on this nice set. And here we just can't squeeze in this nice set because the strip is far too narrow. For outgoing cusp. For ingoing cusp, you can do it in many possible ways. So it's not dangerous at all.
And the
yes, yes, delta. So this delta, the height of this is delta, the height of this is delta. And delta is the constant which appears, not necessarily, but proportional. And delta is the constant which appears here. So if delta goes to zero, the eigenvalue goes to infinity. This is important. Yes. Then the value, yeah, you may have very bad behavior of the counting function. Yes, exactly. Eigenfunctions giving that. By the way, this is, well, I said this is dangerous, but of course we can handle with our technique those cusps. Well, we shall need very many cubes. We can put cubes here, but there will be very many of them. So, well, this is a graph of continuous function, so everything is all right. Our technique works. But the answer, the result, well, the final formula will be worse. Right. So these are model domains, and the last formula I don't want to comment is for a cube, we can obtain whatever we want about the counting function, for example, this formula. And all these constants, CD1, CD2, and so on, are constants which depend on the dimension D. And in the end, I will show a list of these constants. We calculated them explicitly. Right. So it was the next thing. And it's the usual problem. I don't can find the next transparency, which must be number 7. Number 7 is here. Here it is. Now, what we are going to do, as I said, we are going to cover our domain by these model domains. Then we are going to estimate the counting function of each model domain, and so on and so on. So we must assume something about the boundary of the domain. And the boundary, well, is going to be, well, this is the condition. So here we consider a subgraph. We consider just one subgraph of a continuous function. And this is the object which is responsible for the behavior of the Neumann Laplacian. Roughly speaking, this is number of oscillations of the size delta. What is the number of oscillations of the size delta? This is the maximal number of cubes, of the joint cubes, on each of which our function has oscillation at least delta. The maximal number of those cubes. It's a very strange object, but in two-dimensional case, it's most natural. Even in multi-dimensional case, it's more or less natural, in my opinion. This is the number of oscillations of the size delta. By number, I mean the number of cubes on which you have the oscillation of the size delta. So here comes the only difficult result in our paper, and the difficult result is the theorem. The theorem basically says that if we have a subgraph of a continuous function, then we can cover this subgraph by the model domain. You don't have to read all these conditions, they're not very important. So the meaning is that we can cover the subgraph by our model domains such that the multiplicity of the covering is finite and we control the number of these domains. Why I say that this theorem is difficult? It's not really difficult. Every undergraduate student can prove it because there is nothing, you don't have to know any mathematics to prove it. Just take your domain, take your model domain, try to cover it. Do it in a clever way. You can cut off pieces of paper and just try to do it properly. Nothing else. Just a sort of combinatorial problem. But it's not very easy to prove because domains are not very simple. And if you think about the graph of a general continuous function, it may behave very wildly. So you must be careful. But there is nothing special in it. It's a result which can be proved by a child, if this child understands the definition. So this is the most difficult result in our paper. Well, basically it says that we can cover the domain. And here is what we use in the proof of this result. It's a very nice theorem by Bezukhovich, which says the following. If we can cover our compact set by union of open domains, that we can choose, well, this says what it says. It's written here. So we can choose the proper cover of any compact set by open domains, which has these nice properties. So first, this open domains, cubes, cover our set, then the multiplicity is finite, dependent on the dimension, and then, well, the number of the set is controlled in this way. So the number of the sets in our covering is estimated by some constant times the number of some disjoint subset of this covering. And this is the theorem which allows us to use this condition. If we only had a function, we would be speaking about cubes in which our function has oscillations of the size of delta, it wouldn't be useful. So we want these cubes to be disjoint. We want to be able to control the number of cubes by saying that cubes are disjoint. If the cubes are not disjoint, this definition wouldn't make any sense. And Bezukhovich theorem says basically that the number of disjoint cubes or number of all cubes is more or less the same thing. So we can control the number of these cubes by means of Bezukhovich theorem, which relates this condition to the number of cubes in this covering. Again, it's a technical thing. We only need it in order to be able to count our sets. But now everything is fine. We can cover the subgraph of our function by a family of sets in such a way that every set is a model set. In that sense, on rectangle, every set is simple. The multiplicity of the covering is estimated. The number of sets is estimated. And everything is ready. Now we simply apply the Dirichlet norm in bracket and obtain the result. Where is it? Here probably. Before I obtain the result, I have to introduce more conditions. First of all, this is just a definition. So we introduce this class of functions, b, v, t, infinity. Well, my co-author insisted on introducing this class because he's a big expert in function spaces. He said it's a new Banach space, and it has very nice properties. And, well, this is the proper notation for this Banach space. But this is the space of functions for which the number of oscillations is bounded by this function tau, where tau is an arbitrary monotone function. So, Yuri Nitrusov, he is very keen on studying various functional spaces, and here is two results which he proved. Lip alpha is C alpha, Schölder class. So there are these embedding theorems. And BV, he thought, was very appropriate notation. It's a very nice function space, it's very nice notation. He was very happy about this statement. So basically, this means that we want to control the number of oscillations, and we control them with the use of this function tau. Then the next paragraph, I strongly recommend you not to read, because it just, I want to obtain uniform estimates. I want to obtain uniform estimates with constants which depends only on the dimension. But we must know something about the boundary. What do we have to know about the boundary? All these things. Basically, we want to know, the basic condition is the boundary is locally a subgraph of a function from that class. But of course, we must know how many subgraphs are there, what the diameter of our boundary, what are those things, these things. But so it's just sort of collection of objects which will appear in the final formula. If you allow me to remove the transparency, I'm happy to do it, because I can't read it myself. There are so many technical things. So this is a list of constants related to our domain, which will appear in the final formula. If you want to see the transparency, I will give it to you later. Nothing else. But the basic condition is here.
The dark gray font, what up not to read, use dark gray font on light gray background.
Yes, but that's what I do. So let's remove it. Well, to remember that to is an important function, to is a number of oscillations. Well, our boundary is locally a subgraph of a function, continuous function. This function has a finite number of oscillations, which is estimated by the function to. And here's the collection of if we use the notation which introduced in the previous transparency, and the result about covering of the subgraph, we obtain this result about covering the domain. Again, there is nothing interesting in it. It's a combination of the previous result and all these objects which appear on the definition of the domain. Again, the important thing is that we can cover our domain by a finite collection of subsets, the finite multiplicity. We know what the number of these model sets are, what the multiplicity are, so we know everything we want to know, nothing else. And for the Dirichlet boundary problem, we can use this mu. Remember, M is small set, subset of the rectangle, just small sets. It will be sufficient. We don't need this V, those sets, which are more complicated. So the Dirichlet boundary problem is with lambda. So we can cover the domain. The result is really very simple. I shouldn't show this really. And here is the result which is obtained by applying Dirichlet bracketing. What can we say about the Neumann Laplacian? If we have this estimate with the function to is important. This constant was introduced on the previous transparency. This is a precise constant which can be easily evaluated. Delta. So for every lambda greater than delta, we have this estimate. It's not an asymptotic estimate, it's just a precise estimate. Now, this estimate is, I put it here for experts in spectral asymptotics, Professor Ivrin in particular. Every expert in spectral asymptotics knows that if we take a smooth domain, then applying this technique, we don't obtain the best possible estimate. There is a logarithm here. And the logarithm comes from the inside. It doesn't come from the boundary. This is a very important technical thing. If you look at this thing, then in two-dimensional case, this term produces logarithm. But it's wrong. It doesn't. This term produces logarithm. In the two-dimensional case, we can replace this and that. So the boundary doesn't produce logarithm. But logarithm does come from inside. So this... Yeah, when we approach the boundary, of course, but still from the inside. And for the Neumann boundary value problem, this is a very simple estimate, and I'm sure it could be deduced from many other results, but I like it. It doesn't have nothing but, is integral of the measure of the boundary state, nothing else. And this absolute estimate, which is holds true for all bounded and even unbounded domains of finite volume. Just one term on the right-hand side. This constant is quite complicated, I will show it. Right, so these are general results, and, the natural question is how precise they are. Well, as I said, C alpha or Lip alpha, Lipschitz alpha space is a subspace of this space, the suitable choice of Tor. And this is what we obtain for C alpha or Lip alpha boundary, this estimate, and this estimate always hold true. But of course, this term may be of higher order than that. It does happen. Alpha between 0 and 1.
Excluding one.
If you take 1, there must be logarithm, of course. So we have this term, which can be a higher order than this term, than the main term in the Weyl formula. It does happen. And what we know, if we speak about these spaces, that these estimates are precise. Order sharp, in the sense that for every alpha, we can construct domain such that the difference between this and that is estimated from below and above by this term. For every lambda, not for a subsequence, just for every lambda. So this is precise estimate in the scale of C alpha, Lip alpha spaces. I'm pretty sure that these estimates are precise. These estimates are precise for a very wide choice of functions store. But it's a ridiculous question to ask whether these estimates are precise in the scale which is parameterized by a function. How can we prove it? Well, functions are different. So you need some ordering. So alpha, this alpha gives you ordering. So you can say that these estimates are order sharp in the sense of alpha. But one can easily construct many examples for various functions store when this estimate, this difference behaves exactly like this term. By the way, this term is of higher order than that term. The term which appears in the Dirichlet estimate is of lower order than the first term in the Neyman estimate. So this is the list of main results, and I have 30 seconds more to just show you the constants, to show you that we do our job. Honestly, all these constants are here. So every constant which appears in our estimate has a precise value. Of course, they are not precise constants. You can try to improve them, but all of them can be easily evaluated. Well, of course, they behave like d to the power d. Also, for large d, it's not very good estimate, but life is such. So I put back this last transparency which contains the main results, and so that's all. I think it's